Today's guest, I'm sure you've seen him all week, part of our feature jury. He's made a couple of good films. This is kind of an understatement. I thought that deserved a little laugh. No? Jerks. You know his film, The External World, which won the grand prize in Ottawa in 2010, I think. Before that, he had Please Say Something, No Applause, until later. And recently, he did animation sequence for the feature film Her, which you would have seen in the competition this week. He also did a video game called Mountain, where you get to be a mountain, a dream we've all had. Let me bring him out now, Mr. David O'Reilly.
What's going on?
What's in the bag?
Something called Potato Farm.
Oh, I got this bag too, yeah.
You got this bag too, yeah. Right? Yeah. This is from our Japanese
friends. I thought it was special just for me, but...
No, they had hundreds of these to give out. But I didn't have breakfast, so... And I saw this lying on my floor, which is Potato Farm. Have you tried these?
No.
Do you mind?
I have a feeling I'm going to.
You're gonna. Yeah. Thanks everyone for coming.
Have you ever been to a potato farm?
I was grown up on one, you know. I was an actual potato once upon a time.
Yeah. When did the change occur?
It's still occurring. I don't know.
Do you want me to hold something?
Oh, it's like multiple packets. Here we go. We can like give these out. Is anyone hungry?
They're kind of like...
I'm sorry, that was the... Oh, almost. Potato Farm? Oh, it's...
For those listening...
I felt for a minute like David Blaine throwing a card, you know? It was a very short minute. Anyway, thank you for having me here.
Why did you want to make a video game?
Okay, I'll go straight in there. Why not? It's... video games are great. Why would I want to make anything? I just want to make it.
Okay.
There's no, you know.
That answers all the questions.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
No, but is this something you would always wanted to do, or?
I actually used to make games years ago. This is a mess.
People who only listen to this podcast later will be wondering what the hell is going on.
Well, they won't be able to hear it with all the reverb. Like, you had to do this in the biggest room in Ottawa. With, like, marble walls.
Yeah, but it's cool.
It is very cool. This is... You can't see this, but we're in an amazing church right now.
Ex-church.
An ex-church.
Yeah, it was D-something. Deconsecrated?
Or? Deconsecrated.
I don't know what that means, though.
It's they turn the cross upside down.
They vacuum...
Yeah.
The spirits out.
They get rid of them. They bring in the Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Make sure Jesus is gone.
I think he's actually just behind the curtain.
Pardon? Oh, yeah, he's hanging behind the curtain. Behind the curtain. Which is very scary to see.
So you used to make video games.
Yeah, I used to just make little tests and demos. Because the first software I learned was this thing, Blender, which is a free software. And so when I first got into 3D, it was using that thing. And it was like super basic back then. It didn't have an undo function. It was really, really, it didn't have much rigging functions. It was really, really basic, but it did have a game engine built in. And it was really easy to do. You didn't need to program. You could just like hook up little pieces of logic with like visual kind of squares. So anyone could make like a sort of, you know, a little basic game, or a real-time thing. So I don't know, I just made stuff in that for a while and then went, I completely forgot about that because nobody uses Blender in the industry, or not a lot of people do or did. So I went and went over to Maya and then completely forgot about games for ages. And then at a certain point, I kept hearing about Unity, which is this big game engine software. And I just downloaded it and opened it one day, and it was totally unlike, I think, anything I was expecting. And it did a lot of things that, I don't know, I didn't know was kind of possible, in terms of like being able to get stuff from another piece of software, bring it in, and then do stuff with it. Like, it had all this new functionality, and so I just sort of fell into it, and then experimented around, and then somehow I'm now a game developer.
Why a mountain?
Why not?
If you, I knew you were going
to. I don't know, but it's like one of those questions. It's like
I don't think. I think people are going to decide to make a video game. I'm pretty sure no one is thinking, well, I'm going to make it based on the main character or whatever is going to be a mountain.
I think there's nothing real. I like it because there's nothing really trendy or new about it. It's a very sincere project. But yeah, it doesn't have any, I don't know, it's one of those things that it's too simple to take apart. It's too, I don't know, it's just a mountain. I can't say anything else about it. I don't know. Have you played it?
I did open it once, yeah. I had it on my iPad.
Yeah. I'm honestly not a huge fan of the iOS version of it.
Why not?
Because the idea was originally that it would be something that you open and then you leave open in the background of your life and you just sort of leave it going in a small window. But you check on it, you check up on it every now and again. And that was the idea. And so with iOS, it's very easy when you're making a game in Unity to export for iOS. You just change some stuff around. But in this case, it just doesn't feel the same because, like, you never you need it to be running all the time, basically, to get the same experience. And I don't know, it sort of drains battery, and we had a lot of trouble optimizing for it and getting it open and closed. This is so boring. I don't know who's interested in this, but like, yeah. Like, persistence is a thing in games where you're like saving the state and then loading it again, and that was really difficult on iOS because it's not super powerful.
Do you want to talk about something else?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to.
Like something in the news, or?
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. I mean, maybe not. I'm not that smart. Maybe something in the news that was like a few weeks ago.
A few weeks ago.
Yeah, okay. Yesterday's news.
Are you gonna? Do you plan on doing another video game, or is that?
Yeah, I'd like to. Hmm. Yeah. It'd be sweet. I mean, it is such a, it's a very related field, you know, and a lot of people, I remember wanting to get a job in video games at a certain point, and I think everybody has that thought, but it feels a lot further away somehow than animation. I don't know, animation is like, at least when I was growing up, was more of a pervasive thing, and that thing that's on TV, and then games were this, I don't know, seen as this type of drug, or thing that was like gambling. You know what I mean? It had all these like negative connotations, and but now it's like so exciting, and it's such a. If I think anybody who does 3D, it seems to be such a nice alternative thing, or the thing you can basically do. You can still do animation, you can still do design, sound, everything, except it's in an environment that you know you don't know. You can't predict the end result, or you know you can set up. Sorry, I'm rambling.
That's what we're here for.
Okay. Ramblecast.
Ramble what?
Ramblecast.
Ramblecast. That's nice. There's one there. Sorry, I'm just looking at, I thought one was on the floor.
There was, I picked it up.
Okay, let's go back to the chronological journey here of how you got interested in animation. When did that unfold? Where did you study and things like that?
Almost everything about like how I started is revolves around Cartoon Saloon in Ireland, which is a studio that did Secret of Kells. If you guys know that short, that feature, it's really cool. that had just started like something like a couple days after I arrived, I showed up in their office one day, and I was about 14, and they basically, it was just an environment of people drawing stuff and animating tests, and just messing around. And they had computers and all the drawing desks and light boxes and stuff. And I really just fell in love with the environment of it. It was just really, it felt like comfortable. Like I wanted to I suppose I grew up in an environment that was kind of like, it wasn't cool to be that nerdy, to be like sitting down and drawing all the time. And this was like this little pocket, this little bubble of people that just did that all the time and wanted to get better at it all the time. It was just amazingly inspiring. So I just kept going back there every evening after school and every weekend. And I did like really basic, low-end things for them, like inking and painting and scanning drawings. And a little bit of cleanup. And then they finally let me do some e-cards, which was a thing in the 90s.
Yeah.
Was it in the 90s, early 2000s, that was a thing?
Early 2000s.
Yeah. E-cards was this whole world. And so I had to learn Flash. And then that led to, learning other things. So I made, three or four terrible e-cards. But I sold them. And then I got, $100 or something. And it was the biggest thing in the world. And then I kind of...
Are they still online?
No, I went looking for them a few years ago. The company went bust because that was part of the dot-com bubble.
They all went, yeah.
And I think they were for a company called Sugar Cube, Qube, and then the whole thing went under. But they're terrible anyway. It's no great loss to culture. But so I did that and then ended up doing all of the animation, all of their animation course material, the bouncing ball and all of that stuff. I did the first couple of years of that just under their supervision. That was actually the same course. That was the course from Ballyfermot in Dublin, which is shared with Sheridan here. It's the same course. And it's really good. And so I had all this classical training and a bit of Flash, and I was teaching myself 3D. And then I went off to college where it was just like hitting a reset button and going through the same sort of steps again. So I dropped out of there and after a year and went over to London. And I could keep going. I don't know in how much detail. Or if you want me to fast forward, skip over things, make it more emotional. I don't know.
Emotion would be good, yeah. Your father, is he an artist? Or
that's right, yeah. So father's a sculptor.
Yeah.
He wasn't always a sculptor when I was growing up. At a certain point he started. And that's his life now. And he does installations.
So they were supportive of you following animation? Or?
I think the whole family was like, everyone felt differently about it, and I'm sure this is something that I'm not alone in. Like, it is, even though it was more like of a legitimate career than video games, in as much as there was a course for it in Ireland, it was still kind of pie in the sky. So I think half of my family was like supportive, and the other half was like, you're really making a bad decision. But I've had people say you're making a really bad decision a lot of times. And I've learned to just ignore that particular sentence.
Do they still say that?
I've had that with other things. I remember, I'll never forget, when I was... I worked at Studio AKA, which is Philip's studio, who's also on the jury, for a brief period. And I wrote him a letter, and I said, hey, I love your studio. I'd love to work for you. I was 19. I had no degree or anything. And he brought me in, not even as an intern, but as a full-on lead designer person. It was amazing. And I was designing commercials and working on a feature, whatever, feature concepts and stuff like that. I'd never done concept painting before, but I just sort of was learning as I went. And at a certain point, I got really frustrated that I wasn't doing my own work. And, everyone I had gone to college with were making shorts and doing whatever. And I was on this grind of doing commercial stuff, industry stuff. And so at a certain point I decided to leave, and I was saying goodbye to people, and I went downstairs and there was the 2D department of that whole studio. I don't know if it still exists, but at the time it had basically moved down to the basement. This was a studio that was four floors of 2D at one point probably, and now it's just getting sidelined. And I went downstairs and I said to this guy, who's the only classical animator on staff at that time, I said, I'm leaving to do my own stuff. I'm gonna, you know, I don't know, try and make a short or something. And he's like, you're making a really, really bad decision. You don't know how lucky you have it here. You have a good job. You should just stick around for a while, like wait like 5-6 years, you know, they'll let you direct something if you're lucky. And he was really like, put the fear of God in me, kind of about sort of becoming independent or making stuff for yourself or whatever. I don't know what happened to that guy, but I remember how everyone else I had met that day was like, oh, congratulations, like, well done, you know, do it. And, you know, at any studio, I think there's always people that share that thing of just like, I want to do my own stuff. And so there was a lot of that, and then he was just the opposite. He was just like, don't do it. You're making a really, you know.
I'm sure there's a lot of people like that.
Yeah. I think especially, I remember very clearly that like environment of what 2D felt like, the transition, the whole, the sense in the air of what was happening with 2D in the early 2000s. Because it was still at a phase where like Disney was like, you know, we still think it can work. And we still think it's, we should be putting out films in this thing. And, you know, there was all this whole thing of like, it's not dead. And there was a very, that was coupled with a very anti-3D spirit amongst people that, you know, even people that taught me how to draw and everything were sort of had this built-in thing of like, there's like an impending sort of thing. And I think it was legitimate because people lost jobs and things changed, you know?
That's the way history rolls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the new overwrites the old. It cannot coexist. It needs to, like, annihilate.
I just lost my thought there. In terms of education and the skills you acquired, just thinking of the students here, what was more beneficial, to like going to school or just working?
Oh, you know the answer to that one. I didn't get much out of school. And that isn't to be unfair to, I think, though. I mean, it's not nice to say that. I won't mention the school, but like, I honestly was, because I had a taste of two things. One was working in a studio. So like having being around a bunch of like funny people, a little bit older, who were super talented and who could draw anything and answer any question, and get paid to work on stuff that they were into. Like, all of that was, like, amazing. And was just this, you know, I think I have this, you know, we all feel this thing that when you're in an environment like that, it's kind of like you can learn. It's like everyone has these different levels of drawing. It's easy with drawing. You can kind of, drawing is very objective, who's good, who's bad. When you're in an environment of super talented people, you can always kind of, like, get to the, whoever's the best guy, you can totally learn from him and get, like, up, at least close to his level. But if the highest level is down here, it's very hard to get up there. So I was just in an environment of, in Cartoon Saloon, of some people that are genuinely like some of the best drafts people I've ever met on the planet or seen online, even just like super, super talented people. And then, so being in that environment of these like guys who I idolized was one thing, and wanting to get back to that. And the other was having a taste of doing my own stuff, because on the side at Cartoon Saloon, I was making shorts. And I think when you have that taste for, the sort of satisfaction of filming, finishing a personal project, even if nobody's going to see it, it's that thing where you've trained yourself to just like make you laugh or your friends laugh. But then in school, sometimes the situation can be you're just trying to impress your teacher, and That's great if you have a really great teacher that you respect and admire. If your teacher's kind of a bit strange, then you're trying to appeal to, you know, you cannot make something good out of that equation. So I found the environment very difficult to just. It was one of those things where I felt my brain stop learning for a little bit, even though it was like the most concentrated educational period of my life. It was still like I felt like it was sort of backwards. So I got the hell out. And I went, basically, the way it worked is I did a year, and I had like 3 months until the year started again, like the summer holidays. And I was so desperate to kind of leave Ireland that I read up about polyphasic sleeping. And some of you might know this thing. It's another word for it's like the Da Vinci sleeping method thing. So you sleep 2 hours in a 24-hour period by doing 20-minute naps every 4 hours. Have you heard about this?
You've heard about naps. I think they talked about it on Seinfeld once.
Yeah. That's right. They did an episode about it. So I did that for 3 months because it would mean that I would get more stuff for a portfolio, which would give me a better chance of leaving the country. You know what I mean? And sort of.
Why did you want to leave the country? What was so bad?
I think Ireland's very small, and I had an opportunity to, you know, I had a great time working with my friends in my hometown. But I don't think there was any other studio in Dublin that I wanted to work with, and I also felt like I should be doing 3D stuff. And I'd never really done any 3D at that point.
Were there even many studios?
There was probably three, I'd say. Maybe Brown Bag, Cartoon Saloon, and one other one. But my focus was on, like, not... I just wanted to, you know, it's one of those things. You just look at studios online, you just see, like, I really like their work. It would be so cool to see how they do what they do. And it all felt very mysterious. And, of course, you get there and it's all, like, everything's normal all the time. But, yeah, I just wrote to people. And I wrote to Studio AKA was one, and that was, like, Philip's studio. And the other was Shinola, who's some people in this generation aren't aware of, but did some of the most amazing music videos of the 2000s, and really were my heroes at that time. That was the smallest 3D outfit that existed in the world. I think at a certain point they were like, wow, four people doing CG. And so they had never hired an animator before. It was always just the four of them. But I wrote them this letter, and I had a really bad portfolio, truly. But they took pity on me or whatever. And for a long period of time, I was working at AKA until 6 o'clock, Studio AKA until 6 o'clock, and I would get the bus to Shinola. So at 7 o'clock till midnight, I would work on their stuff. And then I would get up and do the same thing over and over again. I don't think I've ever talked about this in any public way, because it's so, at the time, I was probably breaking a rule or a law or something. But I was working for, like, my two favorite places. And
were you doing the power naps then?
No, I couldn't. Those things drove me insane. I was, towards the end of that sleeping experiment, I was hallucinating, waking hallucinations and out-of-body experiences. And yeah, hypnagogic hallucinations, like really weird visual. And it just ruins your social life, because you're like, you go out with some friends and then you have like 20 minutes and then you got to go back and try and fall asleep.
But you're an animator, you don't really have a social life anyway.
I try and keep a balance. I'm pretty good now. I think I've found more of a normal balance at this point in my life. But you know, young people, you're always sick of hearing it when you're young. It's like, you know, it's good to just break your back when you're younger and then get it out of the way then, or try and, you know. But you have to, like, nurture your brain and take care of yourself. Because I've definitely hit walls numerous times where just made me, like, not want to work on stuff. And I think the worst thing that can come out of a job or out of any project is that you start disliking animation. You start disliking going up to the desk. And that happens with me. I know I hit a limit where I'm just like, don't want to look at that thing. And then I am like, I have to assess the situation and be like, okay, what can I do to fall in love again?
You seem, especially the last year, you've got many different little projects. Is that a way you keep your interest as well?
Totally.
If you get bored with this, you just go on.
Yeah.
Go work on this for a bit. And
yeah, like this year has been a lot of smaller projects. And I think the reason is partly because I'd spent the last 2 years doing mostly commercial stuff. The 2 years before this one. So there was like Adventure Time, and then I went straight from that onto Her. And both of those took almost a year each. They're not even that long in terms of length, but Her took about 11 months, start to finish. So, in order to, I and then, you know, I basically, I really missed doing personal stuff. Up until that point, I was just doing mostly independent, like in Berlin, when I lived there before Los Angeles, but that was like 80, 90% of my year was just doing independent stuff. Yeah. And that's where I did all the shorts, like Octocat and RGBXYZ, and Please Say Something, External World, they were all done there. So, and that was, but then my time, and so yeah, I like kind of got very depressed for a while. And then I actually went for a walk, and in the back of my head, this is like maybe January or December, and I went for a walk and I was like, please, like, tell me, like, what should I do this year, you know? Like, it's kind of like thinking about, I'm looking upwards now, we're both looking upwards. So I went for a walk to try and get some ideas, you know, to try and think of stuff that was, whatever I was going to do. And I wound up, my foot fell into, like, I've been on many walks before, but in this case, my foot fell right into, like, this huge, super deep crack in the pavement, and I twisted my ankle, and I was in the most, like, excruciating pain I've ever been in my entire life. And this was on a Saturday night at about 9 o'clock. So I called up, I was like I couldn't get up, so I called my friend who was like lives around the corner. He was like out at some bar and I didn't want to bug him, so I was like, oh fuck, okay. So I called someone else, they didn't pick up. So I was like, I had to crawl under the middle of the street to get a cab to the hospital where I was just like screaming alone.
This is in LA.
This is in Los Angeles, yeah. And then they finally put a cast on me and sent me home with a bunch of painkillers. And I was like, that was exactly what I needed. I just, now I can't do anything for 3 months. And so it was almost like the sleep schedule thing. It was like one of those things where it just allowed me, afforded me a lifestyle where I just had sat and worked for 3 solid months and really concentrated on new stuff. And a lot of it is still things that haven't come out yet, but it was one of those sort of weird cosmic things where I got what I needed, even though it was totally unexpected. And
painkillers.
And plenty of painkillers. I still have a lot of them left over. They just overdo it in the States. They'll just, you know.
When you just go back when you left AKA, mm-hmm. I mean, you say, well, screw this. I'm going to go and do my own thing, which
right.
is easy to say. But
well,
what did you do
it,
when
it
you walked
so out
the door?
It was so naive when I think about it, because at the time I had like, I forget, but it was something like, I had an amount of money in my account from working there for maybe nine months. And to me, it was the biggest amount of money in the world. When I look back and it's like, it wasn't that much. Maybe it was like, I'd worked real hard and I was doing the two jobs and maybe I had like $10,000 in the bank, something like that. But I was like, oh, I can live forever. You know, this is like all I need for the rest of my life. I forget what it was, but anyway, I remember just looking at that and thinking, well, time is money. I can just use that money to do, you know, if my rent is that and I can get food for that, I can just do portfolio stuff. That was actually a really dark period after that, because I was represented for, I left the job and I got represented for music videos. And so, because of my connection, I worked on a music video for Beck with Shinola, and through that whole process had met up with a music video commissioner in London. Excuse me. And he said, I'll take you on. And it was like a novelty thing, because I was 19 and I had no portfolio. And he had me pitch on music videos. So I pitched on music videos for almost a year, maybe about a 6 month period. I pitched on 40 or so music videos. I lost every single one, without exception. And then in between that, I made a video for a guy called Venetian Snares, who's a Canadian musician actually. And I made a fan video for him. That was just a sort of a thing. It's with Thunder and Lightning. I don't know if you've seen it. There's no characters in it.
No, I haven't seen it.
Very old one.
Is it on your site?
It's on my website, yeah. I think so. Anyway, did that. But I was losing pitches left and right. Funnily enough, at the premiere of that video, that free video I did, it was in London. And Spike Jonze was a surprise guest at the screening of that. And someone, I for some reason I wasn't there. I was probably at home or whatever. But someone said that like he dug that and like he mentioned it on stage or something like that. And I was like blown away. I couldn't believe that that had happened. And I only that was like a memory that I totally like I held onto dearly for years, and then I just somehow like slipped away. And then I wound up working for him, which was.
Did that have a role in?
Not at all. He didn't remember. And I don't think he still. I don't think he remembers that. Anyway, so that was a cool thing that happened. But otherwise, it was about a 9-month period of. After being at AKA, of just losing thing after thing, going completely broke, sending my portfolio to every studio, and being turned away everywhere, or just ignored, like no response,
yeah.
Which I understand, but like just being like, I kind of thought like, because I had such a great start, and I really, in both cases, with AKA and with Shinola, they both like were like, we like believed in me. We're like, you're gonna, you know, do good things, and we want to help you out, and whatever. Like it was like. Such a they gave me beautiful like glowing letters of recommendation. Yet nonetheless, I was just.
So you were walking out the cock of the walk. You thought.
I was like everything's gonna be fine, and it was just super long days of inactivity, and just like I was making things, and I was developing ideas. I didn't have any ideas about aesthetic or style or even like worldview or. Point of view on anything, you know, you just don't have that then. But I was getting better at stuff. And
did you ever reach a point where you thought, shit, I better go
back to Ireland,
back to AKA, or
I don't even think they would have me at some point. I wonder if that had happened. I don't know. It was one of those things where every time I would call my parents, it would get more and more embarrassing. It's like I just don't have any news. I don't know what's going on. You know. It was super dark.
When did the light shine?
Well, it happened weirdly. I got an old friend from college sent me an email out of the blue and said, hey, there's this thing in Italy called Fabrica. You might want to check it out. And I forgot the email. And then someday, you ever like wake up and you remember something from months ago and you don't know why it's significant, but it just pops in your head. Anyway, I remembered this thing and I looked up the email and I clicked on the link, and it's this scholarship thing in Italy where they have like a bunch of young people and everyone does different disciplines. Like it's paid for by Benetton, and it's in this crazy building that's set in, like that's dug into the earth in Venice, near Venice in Italy. And it just seemed like a sort of Disneyland for artists or whatever. So I applied and I did a trial, and I got in. And so that was just a thing that was, I was there for, they just kind of let me do my own thing. And so I was there for a period of, I was there for another 9-month period, around roughly like 9 or 10 months. That's where I did the waffle short, the one with like this little thing, this little wolf running around in this forest, which is the first time I got to, that was like the first sort of short film type thing, or first 3D short film I had made.
So you went to Italy.
I lived in Italy, yeah, for like I said, like about 10 months. And so I totally left London behind and left everything, like all of like I ditched, like I had no, I got rid of everything I had owned there, and I just was so grateful to have a way of, you know, kind of getting a portfolio together in an environment that wasn't so. Expensive and kind of like, you know, rainy and oppressive. It was such a like a really dark time. I don't know, like I haven't thought about that in years.
Sorry to bring it up.
No, it's fine, but it's kind of like therapy here. So I went there, I went to Italy, and then I made a bunch of stuff. I made a live action short, I made a few other little, very short things, and I had a chance to really be inspired by stuff, and so I'd never really watched features at that point. I didn't know much about cinema or anything like that. I knew the names of some films, but I wouldn't know. I was into anime. I could tell you any animators. You know, any like I knew a lot of short films and the whole world of animation, but not really anything else. So what was weird about this place in Italy is that it had a private theater, and it was like a 200 seat thing with 35 millimeter projector and digital projector, and it was for Luciano Benetton to come in once a year to look at some film that he put money in. So I became friends with the security guards at this place, and they gave me the key every evening, and I would just, or every day even, and I would go in with just a stack of DVDs and just watch film after film after film. And I did that for months and months, and just watched all of like the great works of European cinema, Japanese cinema, American, everything. And that was like enormously, that was like a whole other thing of, that felt like
that helped
starting again. Pardon?
That helped to start shaping the worldview.
Massive. Well, I think it just seeing what was possible. I think there's a thing that you have sometimes when you're like, you want to do stuff and you're young. You have this thing of like, oh, this, I got all these ideas and no one's fucking done them before and I'm going to like do them. And then you actually look at history. You actually see what's been done. And even in the short century-long history of cinema, like every idea you've had.
Yeah, at some point.
Up until like 23 or 4 or whatever. I don't know. But up until like, you think that you have it, it's all been, there's so much stuff that's been done. And I totally didn't know. If you just watch stuff that's in the theater that comes to the cinema, like the big Hollywood stuff, you have no idea about how cinema language has evolved or what the new language is. And then you see, you watch the history of stuff and you're like, oh my God.
Well, sometimes you hear some mainstream films that are, you read reviews that are describing this cutting edge, this is so new. And
right.
You're like, really? No.
No, the grammar has like, the films that have shaped the grammar of cinema are very like few and far between, and they don't get any credit.
Who were some of the filmmakers that you came away just really had the biggest effect on you?
The first time I ever had to watch a film twice in my life was Tarkovsky's Mirror. Andrei Tarkovsky, yeah. Tarkovsky, the Russian filmmaker. So that was the first time I thought I was completely transported. And all of his films I've seen many, many times.
What was it about Mirror that?
It's such an irreducible, like ineffable thing. It's so poetic and beautiful, yet completely unpretentious and simple, and just a very, very pure description of the world or life or his characters. I don't know. Everything about it felt like unbelievably familiar to me, like I had seen this film already in like dreams or 1,000 times before, but I never had. And it felt like, when the world is described back to you in a way more accurately than you can possibly describe, you feel less alone in the universe. You feel like things are going to be okay. And you feel inspired and you feel somehow enlightened or whatever. That's the thing you're always chasing. And I think he did it with that. And he did it with many other things, but Mirror is just one that it just falls so far outside of any categorization and in almost every way. That, and obviously like Jodorowsky was like great, and watching all of David Lynch's stuff and obvious things, Kubrick, Hitchcock, Chaplin.
What about in terms of your narratives? I mean, you avoid linear narratives. In terms of writing, I mean, does cinema have more of an impact, or is there literature as well that were you reading?
It was just I think it was basically just cinema.
Yeah.
I never mentioned, if someone says like, oh, what's your influences? I don't really mention Tarkovsky because it's one of those things where they're looking for like they're not looking for your actual influences. They're looking for like, what are some ingredients in the soup that makes up your brain? And it's just trying to like simplify, or trying to like reduce it. So there's almost no similarities in some ways between our stuff, but at the same time, it's super inspiring. But yeah, with narrative, I don't know. I kind of like the first time I had to ever think about a story was with that Waffle film, and I didn't know what I was doing at all. And I think that's pretty obvious. But it was just I came at narrative without any formal training. It was just in the case of that film, it was like I did some illustration. I did like 5 or 6 paintings in Photoshop, and then I realize that if you put them in a certain order, that a narrative just pops out. It doesn't, we'll make order out of chaos every time. And so it doesn't, but some orders are better than others, even though you'll have like a sequence of five things, no matter what they are. Say the stuff on this table, you'll find an arrangement that you like better than other ones. And I think it's the same with certain images. And that's one way to approach storytelling, I guess, but like, maybe not the most effective way, but like, if you have images that you like a lot or ideas that fit together, they'll work in many different orders. Your brain will make something out of it, but you'll also find an optimal one that you're like, oh, that actually, you know what, like those two things create a completely new third thing. And that's what a metaphor is, right? It's like two indivisible components that make a new one. So that, so just that simple equation, when that happened in my head with that film, I was like, oh, if I do that and that, that's kind of funny or strange or new. And then it was like accidentally becoming a storyteller or filmmaker or whatever, you know?
All of your, nobody ever talks to you about this, but I've always found there's a sadness to all of your films. A lot of characters who are just struggling to find something, parents or friends, or always seems to be a disconnect. And it seems to run through all the films. So.
I think that's just, it happens a lot in real life.
Do you need a hug?
No, I'm great. I'm a totally like content person. I mean, you know, as much as anyone, but you know, we all have ups and downs and different states of mind that we're in. And I always approached animation with, obviously, as like a fan of technique, and I love watching Disney stuff for its technique and things like that. But the idea is, I couldn't care less. I never identified with a Disney character in my life. I never looked at that and said, that's an inspiring crab or whatever. I've always felt like I couldn't connect to them. What I did connect with characters was with Chris Ware's work with like Acme Novelty Library. Right. And that was the first time I thought, wow, that is taking directly from life. It's just not looking at what's going on around him. It's just completely going for like the actual experience of what being alive is like. And it's doing it with characters that are in a language that is familiar, like cartoons, characters, or whatever. And with other people in comics, in that whole new era, new modern era of comics, there's a whole load of sincere emotion going on, or sadness, or whatever, you know. But that was something where I felt like, why isn't anybody exploring these things in animation, you know? And that more, you know, there's a lot of like people that associate me with a certain style or an aesthetic, but that's so secondary to me to like that the actual things you're talking about. When I decided to like make Please Say Something and, you know, take on this thing of doing like, you know, minimal 3D, it was about what ideas would work with that. It's not just the thing in isolation, like what would look cool, what would be different, you know. And I think that, you know, when we see at this festival, like, you know, with the whole short film world is like new aesthetic, like new style, new thing. I figured out how to do this with this and this. But it's totally useless unless it like has something to say or some idea that actually mixes with it, or that's going to kind of require, at least, you know, that's just being very opinionated about it. But at least that was kind of what, you know.
That's an opinion I share, so.
Yeah, it like, you should justify it.
Yeah.
And not only the idea is just being in animation, but also just the actual aesthetic that you're going to work in, or style or technique. I don't know how we got onto that. What were we talking about? Oh, just this, whatever. Yeah, I mean, the theme, I don't think about themes really, but I do think about ideas that are meaningful to me or like that I find funny or interesting or compelling, you know.
Where were you when you, like, Please Say Something is kind of your first big, I guess.
That was the first big festival film.
Where were you living at that point making?
I moved from Italy to Germany because I knew it was cheap. And it was one of those situations where, again, I had like done a little bit of freelance and I had a little bit of money, but I was like, so this will pay for 12 months of being alive. And I moved to Germany with big dreams of doing I had worked on the film Son of Rambo. I got very lucky and I got a job after Italy, or while I was in Italy for working on Son of Rambo. So I could work on it while I was there. I didn't have to pay rent, so I made some money. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to make a short now. Finally, I'm going to make a big short film. And I moved to this small apartment in Berlin, almost didn't know anybody in that town, and I started work on this short. And I did the whole thing myself. It's 11 minutes, and I've never released it. It's a really embarrassing thing, it's a thing that just didn't work. It was very, it's a work idea, it didn't come out right. And the idea sucked, I didn't know what I was doing. So I was so embarrassed by that. It was like a year down the drain, and I was out of money. So I did another little freelance thing, and I was like, right, I need to like find a way of doing CG really fast. I need to like stop working from the design inwards, and working from the sort of design, trying to get the design and making that into 3D, and letting the 3D make the design, like working sort of from an inward outward perspective, kind of from the software itself, and seeing what the Mac, what would be the most economical way of telling a story. What's an economical story to tell, and what's like I was so kind of like. I felt like I had failed so miserably again at this short that I wanted to do something that was entertaining and short and had this simple 3D stuff and that I would be excited about working on, that was unashamedly digital and, you know, did and had all of these other things. Like I had this, I was just like, it was really formative time, you know, and I really, it's just a short film, but I felt very like, I came at it with a totally, I took it very seriously. I came at it from a totally theoretical perspective and said, like, this is what not only I need to do, but this is like what needs to happen in animation. And so I started working on that and then releasing it. And I was putting these sort of little episode chunks out over a period of time. People don't remember that, but that was the thing.
I remember that.
Yeah, so they were coming out. And that was nice because that kind of keeps you going, you know? But it was funny to watch it go out. A lot of those things are offline now, but people, you could still find old threads on Motionographer and Cartoon Brew in some places where people are just really negative about it. And really negative. Actually, the first time I had something on Cartoon Brew was RGBXYZ, which is a film before Please Say Something, which is very much coming from the same sort of thrust of like, you know, let's fucking just do it fast, get it done. And it's like people are so negative about this type of 3D. Yeah. And some people that were like, people are like reputable people in the industry were just like, this is unfinished, this is bullshit. This is like, you know, not, this is unfinished work and needs polish. And so there was a big, you know, it was just like it was negative reception. And it just took time, but I was so sure about it that I just kept doing it over and over. And then certain people got it, like Amid got it, and like you got it, and you know, certain folks out there like were supportive. And it was obvious. It's funny how some people it was kind of divisive amongst like people that would otherwise get along,
especially with the purists, probably.
Yeah, yeah, and.
Do you just let accidents happen a lot when you're working on something?
I don't know. I mean, as much as it's like there are things definitely that happen that are unexpected and that can be harnessed. And it's a different, but definitely, I mean, accidents were, that was something I was always told that you couldn't do in 3D. It was a 2D, we own, like 2D owned that, ink splatters and lines going awry. But the thing, things go completely bonkers in 3D all the time. Anyone, and I figured that out pretty early.
Yeah.
And I mean, anybody who uses a computer knows that it's just constantly waiting to fuck up on you and just you know, ambush you with some crazy looking stuff. And so I, I don't know. There's always that. All of this stuff. I did this, you know, poster. That's basically like a whole bunch of stuff that is completely digital, but has its own nature to it. That has its own like rhythm and form. That's interesting, and that it's just as like nice as an organic structure. But it's like I don't know. It's something that couldn't be. You wouldn't be able to draw, you know?
Right.
Something that doesn't lend itself to the pencil. It's the pencil lends itself to a certain type of curve, or because we use a wrist, and wrists are based on circles or whatever. So with a computer, it's much more linear and, you know, organized, and it has its own nature. And a whole lot of what I've been trying to do is trying to figure out what that is or explore that.
All right, I think we've gone way past my allotted time. But we'll open the floor here to questions.
I thought we were just getting started.
Well, I know. We haven't even used another few hours.
Yeah.
Can we get a mic out there so the listeners can hear the questions? Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
You mentioned the negative response you got to your 3D work, and in the film External World, there's a very strong comment about the whole art world that I think a lot of us identify with. So how do you deal with and persevere with going on with your work when sometimes it really does feel like everyone's attention is drawn to the screaming kid with the pot, you know?
Sorry, say that last part again.
How do you deal with the feeling that like everyone's kind of drawn to the flashy, loud, popular thing and still want to do things that have meaning and are important to you?
Well, I mean, I think also built in, it's like, that could be a commentary, but it's also just making fun of it. And so I try and see the humor in those things rather than getting upset over it, you know? Certainly there's a lot of, anybody in animation knows, there's a huge amount of like charlatans out there who don't have the talent you have or the skill you have, who make more money. But they're really funny and they're easy to poke fun at. And so, you know, I think you should also be like proud that you're in a field where craft is truly appreciated, and your ability to draw and lay stuff out or tell a story. A lot of those things I think have gone missing from the world in certain areas. Like design in general, I think if you walk down the street, it's different. It's not what it, you know. Things that are in galleries now aren't what they used to be. Well, I'm not talking about specifically modern art, but whatever. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Probably not.
I was wondering, do you do all the sound for your films, or do you work with other people? What's the process for that? Do you like do all the sound for your films?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes, and sometimes I don't. I like to do a sound editing pass where I do really rough. I'll cut up the dialogue to get the lines that I like, and often that's super detailed, and I'll cut in between. It's like surgical, and then I'll put in really rough, like scratch tracks from just a library of stuff. And if I have money and I have a sound designer, they basically redo that whole thing, and I've been really lucky with that because a lot of people like to mention the sound stuff, or they're almost as into the sound as other things. And a lot of it is just just that the skill of people that, you know, I've worked with in that world. A lot of the short films are scored by Bram Mandersma, who's a Dutch guy, and he did all of the music for External World and helped me build a little recording studio in my living room, and is just an amazing person, like a one-stop shop for audio, and it's a collaboration. You know, I really love it, but I don't have the sensitivity for sound that I have for pixels.
Hi, you mentioned a lot about like moving from place to place.
Uh-huh.
So was that really hard for you in the sense of like being farther away from your family and friends, or did you know that was just something you had to do to get better opportunities?
I don't know if it's either. I think a lot of that's just guided by, it's sort of influenced a lot by work. Like what is the situation, what is the optimum? Like you can't force yourself to be creative, but you can force yourself to get ideas, but you can influence the conditions around you that allow for you to get ideas, right? Like you can set up the sort of situation. You can make sure that you're in a place where, you know, you can comfortably do stuff. And so everything has been sort of influenced by that, like what is the sort of optimum environment for me to be like working in? And in some cases that's like, what's the most isolated it can be, and other times it's like, well, what's more, what would be, you know, where can I find more people to work with or whatever? So it's you know, yeah, it's guided by work and random, just chaos as well. I don't know.
Is it ever guided by voices? I had to do it once.
I didn't know what that reference was. Like, so I guess you should explain that, Joe.
I was wondering, do you have a favorite character that you created or a favorite short that you made?
No. The next one. Short, not question.
Hey, so most of your animated work is comedic, and yet I think like the one that you're probably most well known for is Please Say Something, which is like a kind of a dramatic narrative. What was the process of what was the inspiration for getting into that dramatic narrative, or working with the dramatic narrative, and what was the process versus working on your, I guess most of your other work is comedic. So what were the differences between working on the two?
Well, it's funny, like people still laugh at Please Say Something a whole bunch, but it is a very straight narrative. I didn't expect that to happen at all when I was working on it, but I think they come from the same place. It's just chasing ideas for what's the most interesting thing. And you know, with Please Say Something, it set out to be just like a classic, like a love story. And so when I did that, I was like, okay, well, what's left? And then I just became interested in other things. And I like, it's hard to separate the dramatic ideas from the comedic ones, because they totally sit next to each other in my head. And I watch, you know, the things I like watching are totally that, you know, like it's they're sort of linked up. So I don't know what the difference is, like, really. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm at a loss for words. It's really weird. It's like, if, you know, when you get up, like I totally forget most of the writing process on everything. It's something that like enters, like the same way like you get an idea and then you instantly forget it unless you write it down. The whole process of actually writing down the whole things, I completely somehow goes into some part of memory that it just wants to get rid of as soon as possible. So I'm sorry. Yeah, that's
happens to me with books.
Yeah.
Read a lot of books, but I can't remember any.
Like,
if you remember
were to
the
think
author's
back
name, maybe in the title.
Yeah.
But
And there's that, yeah.
I don't know where it goes.
Hi. This is just a question to get at your personal taste a little bit. You spoke a lot about narrative and sort of movies, you know, or film whose narrative tries to penetrate at some essence of life, whether that's, you know, Tarkovsky, whether it's like the external world. There's some essence of life that's being reached for in those films. And, you know, you contrasted that with sort of Disney characters and that sort of, I don't know how you would describe it, but, you know, to you that doesn't quite match up to that sort of power of film to depict life. So I'm wondering how you feel in that sort of same capacity about animation that's, you know, comedic, that's funny, things like The Simpsons, not specifically The Simpsons, but The Simpsons as you know, to represent that kind of genre of animation, especially animation for adults, where the appropriate response to life seems to be the sort of like, ha-ha, you know, kind of cool dude detachment, like, you know, Homer Simpson kind of person. And there's a lot of non-animation that features those same kinds of characters, like Larry Smith and those kinds of people. It's like, yeah, whatever. What's your sort of response to that?
Well, that's a lot. Well, I should say that, like, I have a lot of respect for Disney. It's something that I don't ever feel like in any way this, like, my only thing was that, you know, I want to have a character that, like, I don't necessarily know in Disney films that there's like blood running through the veins of these characters. And as far as, like, you know, there's obviously a lot of like throwaway characters, and I certainly use them too sometimes to suspend an idea on. But I like to. The most interesting ideas I find are where are they're just more psychological. I love slapstick and physical comedy and all of that stuff, at which you could say like psychological stuff is like the opposite of. It's to me that just all that stuff feels a bit more relatable or sincere or funny when you treat everybody like humans and give them a tone or attitude or voice that's not very cartoony. I was blown away by, like, when I was working on Adventure Time and we did the voice record, everyone talks like they're in a cartoon. It's like that's the voice of cartoons, and I never thought about it before. But human beings don't talk like that. Like, you know, people don't actually. You know that.
No, they don't.
No, but it's the default way of all cartoons. And if you just think about that, like if you're a little bit deaf, if you covered up your ears a little bit, and you're just watching a cartoon, you don't need to look at the screen to know it's a cartoon. It's like. And then you scroll through the drama, and it's like just the tone is just very different, and it's more measured and solid and stuff. So that was a thing I never even thought about before, but I had been unconsciously aware of, which is that there is that sort of nattering thing, and yeah.
In a lot of your short films, there's a lot of healthcare spaces, like nursing homes or hospitals.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
In a lot of your short films, there's like healthcare spaces, like pharmacies or hospitals or nursing homes. I'm wondering why it's a preoccupation, or do you know why you are curious about that or circle back there?
I've never even thought about that. I have no idea. But yeah, it's a funny thing. Like, very often I'll find myself in a situation where I'm like, this is the eighth car I've modeled, or this is the eighth like bookstore thing I've done, and I forget that I've actually done this already, and it's true. Like, I reuse models, you know? And so I have, like, an old pill model from, like, 9-10 years ago that I still use. I have the same model for a chair that's, like, 10 years old. I've just find an idealized version of a thing, and I'm like, okay, well, why would I need to update that, you know? So, yeah. I don't know what the preoccupation is.
Let's say two more questions.
You mentioned that at some point you just began doing what you felt animation, like 3D animation, had to become in the future. So, like, how would you feel if mainstream studios were starting to get inspired by what you're doing and, like, use this to make mainstream movies?
So you say, how would I feel?
Do you think it's actually possible that at some point in 20 years, let's say, studios would use your style to make mainstream movies?
I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I think it's already happened with commercials, that it's become kind of cool. So, like, I've seen, like, plenty of commercials and music videos, and
I certainly see it in the entries too.
Right.
There's little homages, we'll call them politely.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, it's like, you know, photography came along and people were painting very realistically, by and large. And then photography came along and then suddenly people are allowed to, suddenly discover impressionism and expressionism and all of the sort of various genres of styles of painting that we had in the last century. And it only happened, we could have done that, like that could have been done 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, but it only was discovered when, you know, that all of these things, when people figured out you could take a picture really cheaply. And so I don't see, so it's the same with 3D, it's like as soon as it gets, it's like, okay, you can do it realistically. There's always going to be space for all the other things. They won't necessarily be the biggest, but we're all doing the same sort of job for different audiences, and it's something that might always be on the sideline, but I don't think it makes it less, you know, I don't know, impactful. I don't think if studios never adopted it, I wouldn't care. If they did, I wouldn't care. It's fine, you know? Yeah.
I have a very important question for you. Just
definitely
to close
not
this.
Going to be important. I can
definitely.
Tell.
I want more of those snacks. Do you have some left?
Pardon?
Do you have more left of the snacks?
Oh, yes.
Thank you. Somebody help here.
Okay. Wow. Okay, now that's the last question.
Okay. Do you have any more snacks?
That's what it comes down
to.
That's
the quote of the morning.
Well, thank you for doing this, David.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me at the festival. I had a great time. I didn't get a chance to say it, but I do love Ottawa. And it's been a crazy week. I feel slightly punished to have to do this on the final morning.
Yeah.
After the biggest night.
We don't really think about this when we're doing the schedule.
No, absolutely
not. Anticipating those factors, even though they happen every year.
Yeah. But it's been a delight. So thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming.